Peter Sanders.
Good morning, Alan Friedman, board member.
Good morning, Benjamin Miles, board member.
And we've got a number of staff members that support the Board of Pharmacy with us as well.
Good morning, everyone. Shauna White, Executive Director.
Latasha Gaskin, Health Licensing Specialist.
Luann Greenaway, Health Licensing Specialist.
Ron Collins, Board Investigator.
Carla Williams, Board Counsel.
Now, if we could please ask each of you to identify your name and your organization you're affiliated with, please.
Hi, Jennifer Thomas with Claret, QIO of DC.
Denise Feluco with Walgreens.
Don Jawater with DC Public.
Alameda Banjo, Safeway Pharmacy.
Victoria Zhu with Safeway Pharmacy.
Danan Abadel with Safeway Pharmacy.
Kasha with Howard College
of Pharmacy. Andrew Gentles with the President of Washington, D.C. Pharmacy Association.
Kay Adebayo, Howard University College of Pharmacy.
Michael Monet, Cardinal Health.
Delisa Winston, Grubbs Pharmacy.
Tracy Manning, Howard University College of Pharmacy, Grubbs Pharmacy.
Cindy Governardi, Howard University College of Pharmacy.
Nicole Dornbush, GW Medical Faculty Associate.
Monet Stanford, Kaiser Permanente.
Daniel J. Walmart Pharmacy.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you all for joining us. We have another arrival. If you could just please introduce your name and affiliation.
Jonas Terry, Pharmacist, Department of Healthcare Pharmacist.
Wonderful, thank you. All right, well, let's get underway with the agenda as presented, starting with approval of the opening session minutes for several past board meetings. I know we provided these minutes out to members of the board in advance. I think we should probably go through each one individually in case we have to make any particular changes or revisions to the minutes. So if a board member could let me know if you'd like to make a motion as it relates to the March 1st, 2018 open session.
Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Yes, please.
For the March 1st minutes, because we had only four members present at that meeting, two of those members are no longer on the board. You will never be able to achieve a quorum for that set of minutes. So I'm recommending that the board approve it by general consensus, and we place an asterisk on the document just to explain what happened, because otherwise they will just sit on here indefinitely.
And so to clarify that for folks, two members of our board rotated off following the March meeting. They were here for the meeting, but they rotated off. We now have one of those two board seats filled with another consumer member, but those two individuals are no longer on the board, hence the recommendation from legal counsel about how to proceed. With that in mind, then, counsel, should a member of the board make a motion that it's a consensus of the board to approve the minutes?
Yes. One of the members that was here.
I move that we approve.
Thank you, Dr. Miles. Is there a second for that motion?
A second.
Thank you very much, Freeman. With that in mind, I'll ask if there are any other comments as it relates to those minutes. All right. Seeing nothing, I'll ask then the motion of the board to vote as a consensus to approve the March 1st minutes as presented. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? The motion carries unanimously. Thank you. Next on the minutes is the minutes for the April 5 open session of the Board of Pharmacy. Were we impacted in a similar fashion, Council, for the April 5 minutes or not? Just for the one set.
I believe it's just March.
Just March. Thank you. So, April 5 minutes, if people have comments.
So, we didn't have an open session in April unless we were here in May.
We might have had a limited open session. Are there minutes?
I don't see the minutes in here.
Were minutes provided?
I don't see the minutes.
April 5th.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I see on the side.
So from the notes, there were only two members.
There were only two members present.
There were only two members present? So there were no official minutes then?
Yeah.
So they will not need to be approved. If there were only two members present, there was no quorum for the meeting, so that would not be. Those are not official minutes. They'll just always be listed as unofficial.
Thank you very much, Council. Moving on to the June 7 open session minutes.
Do I have a motion around that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I move that we approve the open session minutes from June 7, 2018.
Good. Thank you. Is there a second for the motion? All right. Any comments on the minutes as presented? All right. Hearing none. All those in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you. And then finally, in terms of minutes, the July 5 minutes. They are presented in your background materials. Do we have a motion to take action on from the July 5th minutes?
Okay, so I move that we approve the minutes as presented for July.
Okay, is there a second for the motion? Okay. The one thing, thank you, Chiquita. The one thing I will note is it does not indicate who. On the minutes as presented, does not show present versus absent. Because some individuals were not present, I think, for that July 5 meeting that was shown. So if we could just be sure to insert as appropriate before they get our comments. So all those in favor then of approving the July 5 minutes as presented, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions?
One.
Let the minutes show that Alan Freeman is abstained. I think you were present. Thank you. There are no items on the consent agenda. We'll have the report from the executive director, and I recommend if you would have stand to give your report so that it projects better to the back of the room. I think the air conditioning is lovely, and it also makes it impossible to hear.
Good morning, everyone. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so currently we have 2,117 pharmacist licenses in the District of Columbia. Our numbers keep growing. 637 of those pharmacists have vaccination and immunization authority. Currently we have over 1,000, specifically 1,007 pharmacy technicians in the District of Columbia. We have 229 pharmacy technician trainees. We have 657 pharmaceutical detailers. We have 10 approved pharmacy technician training programs. And we have 772 pharmacy interns. I have a few announcements here from the Department of Health. Next week, on August the 10th, the District of Columbia Department of Health, in collaboration with Compassionate Choices, is having a conference on a humane and peaceful end-of-life choices, or what you may be familiar with is a Death with Dignity program. That conference will take place at the United Medical Center Auditorium, and that location is 1310 Southern Avenue Southeast. And the time of the program will be from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. I have some flyers here, so if you are interested, please let us know. We will get you a copy of the flyer to pass out to your organization. Also wanted to comment on the prescription drug monitoring program. We had an advisory committee meeting last month. So we wanted to make sure that pharmacists know that there is a prescription drug monitoring program, and we are increasing awareness about the prescription drug monitoring program to ensure that pharmacists and prescribers are not only enrolled but also using the prescription drug monitoring program and checking when they see patients. So you will probably be getting more information about that in your email, so I just wanted to bring that to your attention. So if you are currently working in a pharmacy and your pharmacists are not enrolled in the prescription drug monitoring program, I charge you as pharmacists to have them enrolled and also make sure you're checking when you see patients. I'm going to mention the DEA drug take-back. It is not until October, the end of October. I'm not quite sure of the date yet. However, we only have one open session meeting, and that next one is in October. So just be on the lookout for information. We'll push out some information about the National DEA take-back in October. The Board of Pharmacy is also responsible for clinical lab practitioners, and I just wanted to give the board an update from the Mayor's Office of Talent and Acquisition, what we like to call MOTA. So MOTA has completed filling all of the clinical lab practitioner advisory board member slots, so they have given the board to go ahead and the clinical laboratory practitioner advisory committee can start having meetings. So I wanted to bring that to you.
Can you provide any more detail regarding those meetings and who from this board would be participating in that process?
Right. So that is what the board can decide who will be participating. My recommendation is to do that through the Legislative and Regulatory Subcommittee. Mm-hmm. However, it is up to the board to decide how they would like to have the advisory committee meetings, when they would want to have the meetings, and to kind of structure that.
So do you want a conversation about that now?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I'm wondering if whether you think it makes sense to have one or more board members be part of the advisory committee, and then that group make recommendations to the board, or the board channel information and sort of a request for deliverables to the advisory committee, where no board member would sit, the advisory committee would then come and make recommendations to the board here. I mean, does staff have a recommendation for how we would participate with the committee? What do you envision that engagement being?
Well, I think the best way to do it is to have the committee meet separately in the board request and set like maybe a timeline as far as deliverables for the advisory committee. I don't necessarily think that you all need to meet frequently with the advisory committee, maybe one or two times, but the committee, they are the subject matter experts in clinical lab practice, so I think that it will be good to kind of let them work amongst themselves because they are the experts in working in that field.
And second question is, in terms of getting going, it's been a while since, was it legislation or regulation?
Legislation.
So it's been a while since we've seen that. Were there specific requirements in the legislation in terms of things that they needed to start doing, or is it up to us to decide what their agenda becomes?
So I don't have the regulations in front of me right now, but
okay. So they're an advisory board. They're not separate from you. Their authority is really to advise this board.
Okay.
Because you don't have the subject matter expertise, you'll need to get information from them. But whatever they do comes to you as a recommendation. And then it's for this board to act as you deem fit based on that recommendation. The first thing they need to do is help you prepare the regulations to license or register and then regulate those different professions. My opinion is that they're new, and even though they may be subject matter experts in the field, they know nothing about regulating the health profession. You do. So I would recommend that initially, at least until they are familiar with what they need to do and how to do it, that you meet with them, at least advise the subcommittee and work with them together on the regulations, and they can help provide the subject matter expertise, but you can provide general guidance of what we need, because we know how to regulate a health profession. Then as they are moving forward and through your charge of regulating these professions, you will need to rely upon them if we get complaints or how to actually regulate these professions. So they will help inform the board's decision on taking the actions. Like the orders, like if someone's going to be suspended, it won't be a suspension order coming from the advisory committee. It'll be coming from the board's pharmacy. So you'll want the information provided by the advisory committee. So I think you're going to feel your way through this and see how much you need them and how often they need to meet. Initially, you're going to need to meet a lot because we have regulations that we need to create. And then later, as we're going through just regulating those professions, then you may need to meet with them maybe on our off months. Maybe, and it may, maybe that's too often. Maybe it would need to be quarterly. So I think we're just going to have to kind of play it by ear and feel our way through this. But initially, there should be some sort of meeting, I think, with the whole board, just so that we all know who we are and they see what we do, okay. And you do. And then the board would probably recommend that the legislative subcommittee start working with them on the reg and make that one of your higher priorities, because we're well behind the ball on that one. But it's not our fault because they weren't appointed until very, very, very recently. So that's where we are on that.
That's really helpful. So would the first order of business then be to invite them to, let's say, our October public session meeting and maybe have as an agenda item just sort of introductions and a little bit of discussion about how we're going to move forward? Does that sound reasonable to the board?
Carla, is any motion required on any specific action related to this group? And that first get to know them seems like a very plausible, reasonable first step. But there's no no motion required.
I think
required
you can agree to that.
Great.
And that's fine.
Love it. So then you'll issue an invitation to them to please join us at that meeting.
Yep. So I'll issue an invitation to the Clinical Lab Practitioner Advisory Board to join us at our October open session meeting. And I wanted to note for the record that the chair, Dr. Bernard, is here. And I was wondering if Dr. Bernard wanted to give me updates about the NAVP District 1 and 2 meeting we will be having September 20th and 22nd.
Yeah, so actually, so if it's okay, I'll kind of save it till I give the subcommittee report. But for now, anybody who's interested, you can check out the website. First of all, I apologize for being late. A lot going on in August. But I'll give I guess, pass around the actual official program for the meeting. The copies are actually being made. We have a final program that actually has been complete with the CE details and the UAN numbers for all of the programs. You guys can take a look at it. The website is a lot more informative than what you're going to see on the program. The program is also posted on the website as well. That website is districtmeetingdc2018.com. But yeah, so right now, now that everything is posted, we're hoping that we see a tremendous spike in registrations for the actual meeting. We were anticipating anywhere between 150 to 200. We are far from that number, and we are less than 60 days out from the meeting. And that meeting is September the 20th through the 22nd at the Washington, at the Hyatt Washington on Capitol Hill. Hyatt Regency Washington on Capitol Hill. So that's an update with the meeting. We have a phenomenal program as planned. We've done some pretty good fundraising. Now we just need people. So again, once you see the program, hopefully there's something that's on the program that will pique your interest, and you can either register and hopefully tell a friend or a colleague so that they will register as well. The audience that's intended for the meeting are the decision makers. If you look at our website, that's kind of the tagline that we kind of put. This is the meeting of the pharmacy decision makers in districts 1 and 2. There will be 37 schools and colleges and I think 14 state boards of pharmacy represented, and I think there are probably about 5 Canadian territories that we hope to actually participate as well. They usually come to the annual meeting. I don't think they tend to come to the district meetings, but we really do hope that we will get some of them to actually come down for our District 1 and 2 meeting. Our keynote speaker speaker is Dr. L.B. Brown. Lawrence Brown is the past president of APHA. Phenomenal speaker, a phenomenal mentor. I think his message is something that will resonate with all in attendance. And so, again, these will be faculty, students, deans from schools and colleges of pharmacy, as well as regulators or state boards of pharmacy from across districts 1 and 2. So it's going to be a great meeting. Mm-hmm. For those pharmacists who are interested in getting CEs, you'll be able to get 4 CE hours from 4 CE credits from the attending. All right, so we're going to jump into the next item on our agenda. And that is, are you done?
Yes.
Okay. All right, so the next item on the agenda is the subcommittee report. So we'll have Mr. Freeman give the legislative and regulatory subcommittee report, please.
The Board of Pharmacy and the Board of Medicine representatives from each agency had their second meeting to address Defending Access to Women's Healthcare Services Amendment Act of 2017. As previously mentioned, this legislation will offer pharmacists the ability to prescribe contraception. And Dr. Miles, Dr. McCants, and myself our board members represent the Board of Pharmacy, along with Carla and Shauna. And then there are three members of the Board of, Board of Physicians?
Medicine.
Board of Medicine, as well as counsel and executive director. And so at this last meeting, we looked at guidance that's provided right now by other states. So specifically, we looked at California, Colorado, Oregon, thank you. And we're following closely Maryland because they're on pretty much of a parallel path with the District of Columbia. And we talked about the most efficient use of time and the best approach, targeting, if at all possible, a July 1, 2019 implementation. As we move closer to that time, I think we'll have a better appreciation for whether we'll be able to meet that. And at the last meeting, we decided to delegate out responsibilities. So we're looking at developing an algorithm that will essentially define the end-to-end process. We're also developing a patient self-assessment. We're also looking at training requirements and continuing education, and there may be one or two other pieces of the puzzle that we're looking at as well. So each of us has been delegated a certain responsibility or a couple of responsibilities to report back to the team at our next meeting, which will be in September. And then at that meeting, we'll decide, once we approve the documents that are being worked on, the next steps moving forward. And that's our committee meeting update.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for that wonderful work of the subcommittee members. As we know, tending to the legislative and regulatory affairs is a big job and takes a bit much. And so we appreciate all the effort that you guys put into keeping things moving. The next item on our agenda is a communication subcommittee report. And so the main thing for communications, I think, is the work that's been going into trying to get more attendance for our upcoming district meeting. And so in the NABP newsletter, in our last NABP newsletter, you will see that we actually did announce the district meeting so that individuals are aware and they can get the information so that they can go on and register. We actually have an opportunity to submit for an upcoming newsletter as well. Not sure if we're going to submit anything, because in terms of content, anything that's content worthy outside of our upcoming meeting, we haven't really identified some key things. But if not, if not next month, then you'll see a newsletter that will be posted in the off cycle, which will be in October. So either in the September or the October edition. Again, you can go to the NABP website and you'll see all of the district newsletters posted. They're archived there. So if you'd like to check any of those out, they are available for your review.
One question, one comment. Question. Oh, so I think in the past we've done email blasts to pharmacists licensed and technicians registered in the district and for the drug representatives as well. Would it be possible to do an email blast announcement? I know it went out in the NABP newsletter, but that's a fairly, I mean, there's a lot to read in that. People may or may not have gotten to it, but just a blast that's specifically targeted towards this, letting everybody know about it, and perhaps including the link. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's just another communication opportunity to enhance awareness.
Yeah, absolutely. If we can work with DOH, we can get that done. Also, NABP posted the meeting information in the web in the meeting webpage on the main NABP website. They did that a couple of months ago, which I think was a pretty good move as well. Dean Tafade from the College of Pharmacy had an actual announcement made at the recent AACP meeting. I sent her the final program earlier this morning. She's going to circulate that around to all of the schools and colleges of pharmacies as well. I cannot speak highly enough of the outreach that she's been really doing with the schools and colleges of pharmacy, and I hope that translates into a significant number of schools that are actually showing up for the district meeting. But, yeah, she's really been working very hard with other deans around so that we'll have good representation at the district meeting. But an email blast, I think, is a good idea.
Okay, so if we can get that out this month?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, we should be able to get that out.
Because I think there's an early bird registration around the 20th. Yeah.
And so in the email and the blast that I suggested that she sends to all the deans this morning is to let them know that we are a little bit more than 14 days from early registration. Early registration ends on the 20th.
Right.
And so we don't have that much longer for individuals who want to get the discount and register early. So I suggested that she puts that in the tagline that's going to go to all the schools and colleges. And in the email blast, then I think that's a good idea as well. We have a little bit longer on the hotel. The hotel, they'll keep their room blocks until August the 30th. And that information is posted as well. But for registration, it's August the 20th, early bird.
And my comment is, you were talking about the deans at the College of Pharmacy. I'm sure as we get closer or after the conference, there'll be an opportunity for well-deserved thanks. But I just want to let everybody know right now that there's a lot of work that goes into planning this, much more than I realize. And I just want to recognize right now Dr. Bernard, because she really, as president of the district and active participant on all the calls, working with folks in the other from the other states are going to be participating. I know she's been on all the calls. She's been doing the local calls. There are a number of board members that have been chairing different work groups as well. But Dr. Bernard has really been the mover and shaker here. And if for not her, we would not be where we are as far along as we are. So, you know, you've helped us meet all the deadlines. You've got information out. And we've really pulled it all together. I can. It's. I'm sure very time consuming for you. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate that, but I honestly have to tell you, it's a team effort. It really is. And I really did underestimate. I'll tell you what I underestimated. That thing that you have in your hands there, the program. Hindsight is 20/20. If I had to do it all over again, we would have gotten that thing done months and months ago. So I am my biggest critic, and I learn from my errors. But anybody in the audience, if you have a meeting that you need to plan, the first thing I suggest you do is get your CEs, get that program finalized, get that together, and then keep focusing on fundraising. And by the way, we've raised more money for this meeting than last year. So we are really, really happy about that. So right now we got money. We just need people. We got money. We got a great program. Great location. We just need the people. So, yeah, but, yeah, it really is a team effort. And for you guys really showing up on those calls on Fridays, I really appreciate it. So we're going to have an awesome meeting. We're close, but it's going to be awesome. So, all right. And, again, check out that website. Check out the meeting website. I just pulled it up. That thing. Let me just give you the link again. You can pull it up on your phone, too, by the way. DistrictMeetingDC2018.com. Check out that website. Great information. All right, back on the agenda. Let me get us caught up. All right, so the next item, NABP e-newsletter. So there are a couple of things I just wanted to point out. I'm not going to bore you with reading all the details, but as you all are well aware, there remains quite a bit of focus on the opioid crisis. And as you all know, where there's focus, a lot of times there's money. And so there are some grants that are out there. One of the main ones that individuals have been talking about is the SAMHSA grant. So SAMHSA announced a $930 million funding opportunity for states to kind of come up with a strategy of how they are responding to the opioid crisis. I am pleased to tell you that the District of Columbia is on board and working, have been working, to submit a proposal for the funding. Now, where that's going to divvy up from the talk, it almost seems like a lot of the focus is going to be on the mental health piece and crisis, what do you call it, those crisis centers, especially 24-hour crisis centers, because what's being discussed is we're finding out individuals who show up in the emergency rooms or they're found somewhere, you know, at a party on the street and they are overdosing. It's one thing to take them to the emergency department, but where there's a gap is what happens after that. And so what some of the leadership in the District of Columbia have been deciding or thinking on focusing a bit more on is having a next step, having a crisis center and a crisis program. And we don't want to jump and go ahead and say like a rehab program, because we acknowledge some people, they're not there yet. They're not ready for that. For those in the audience who are familiar, remember when we did the smoking cessation training? Remember, when you come across a patient, a client, a consumer, the first thing that we need to do is assess where they are in terms of their readiness to quit, and you kind of meet them where they are. And so my point is, we don't want to just focus on medication-assisted treatment programs, MAT. We want to focus on other alternatives where there can be some counseling, especially peer counseling, and some really some interventions, some 24-hour centers where these individuals can go, so that at least we can start that conversation about changing how things are going in their lives. So bottom line is there's grant funding out there. For those of you in the audience who are into opportunities, think of a niche that you can find as it relates to this opioid crisis and take a look, because, again, there's a lot of grant funding that's out there that's available. D.C. has its own story to tell. Right now what we're doing is we're kind of trying to decide on what our tagline is going to be as we talk about what the opioid crisis looks like in D.C. I think the last thing we kind of tossed up around out there was like no deaths or stop deaths or something kind of interesting. But anyway, the bottom line is we're really in the conversation and hoping to do even more here in the District of Columbia as it relates to the opioid crisis. And that's really the main thing. There was a recall on the naloxone hydrochloride on that same note. Apotex recalled their, Apotex recalled the fluticasone spray, but be on the lookout for additional information on the naloxone issue, because, as you know, that's something that we don't want to get wrong if we're going to be using that. For the most part, everything, I don't think there's anything else that really stands out, per se. Any questions or anything about anything that you might have seen in the NABP newsletter that's out there? No. All right. The next item on the agenda, matters for consideration of the board. We don't have any matters for consideration that I know of. we will have a presentation.
Yep.
All right. So now we are going to turn things over to our presenter, Dr. Michael Monet, who will come and present to us on telepharmacy. So I'm going to scoot over.
Thank you very much. Good morning. And actually, I looked at your schedule, and you get me today, so you guys are getting a preview of what Jessica's going to talk about at District 1 and 2. And Jessica will do a much better job than I will. I'm sort of like the bottom of the barrel of presentations when it comes to this, because everybody on the team has been out of the country now on PTO. It's August, so everybody's on PTO. But I did look at, I will be at District 1 and 2, and having put those together, she underestimated the amount of effort that goes into putting one of these meetings together, because I did two, one for District 3 and one for District 4 when I was in different roles. So telepharmacy, the interesting thing about telepharmacy is the fact that, okay, it worked earlier. No, it's not. Turn it on. I remember one of the people in my office many years ago said, I can't get my computer to work, and all you had to do was turn it on. But thanks for turning it on. So, interestingly enough, when you look at DC, you already have the basic core concepts in hospitals. And what we're looking at, and you'll see some graphs and some projections over the course of the country, you look at the need for alternative delivery of both product and services. It's not just the delivery of product. The ability of pharmacists to engage in other mechanisms for engaging patients, but through the use of prescriptions. You've seen over a course of time the number of rural pharmacies. Now, you wouldn't necessarily think the District of Columbia is rural. Of course, it is not. But there are places in the District of Columbia that have access problems. And so think beyond the identification of what rural means, and think of it in terms of access to both pharmacist product and services. North Dakota is, and North Dakota you would expect to be, the quintessential hallmark of a rural area using technology to be able to deliver both product and services. The product from pharmacies, but also the key, which is the pharmacist's ability to communicate that information and get the medication to work. The key thing about this is they did this in 2008. If you look at your, and I think it's 1917 is your regulation on telepharmacy, you'll note that you guys put that in 2008. The history suggests that it's 2008, about the same time that North Dakota is looking at it as well. So 2008, this is what the landscape of the use of telepharmacy in remote settings look like. You'll note that it's predominantly rural areas. What you have today in 2018 is this west-east migration. And the arguments as you go from west-east become much more complicated because the rural analysis makes sense out here. The difficulty you have is nobody thinks of themselves as rural, with the possible exception of Maine and a few other places. Nobody thinks of themselves as rural on the East Coast. You have to focus yourself on access. And when you look at access, you can look at access from hospital clinics, being able to provide pharmacist products and services. You can look at it as putting a remote dispensing or remote supervision actually in the physician's office, where the pharmacist is remotely supervising a technician, and the patient is able to receive the product, as well as through the use of technology, the value of the pharmacist communicating with them through a HIPAA-compliant telecommunications medium. And it's about adherence. Everything that we talk about in pharmacy practice, and years ago I used to talk about the idea that it would be really great if we actually could get everybody to get the prescribed drug and get the utilization up to 100%, the adherence up to 100%, so we actually knew what drug therapy cost. Once we did that, then the value of pharmacists in getting not the prescribed drug, but the right drug to the patient would be able to, bless you, to be able to demonstrate an additional value in the system. We got them to take their medicine. Now let's get them to take the right medicine by virtue of what we're doing. So our value is getting them to take it, but then getting them to take the right drug as opposed to, in some instances, just the prescribed drug. And when you look at it, you look at this conversation of how many people actually take the medicine that was prescribed. Now, it's gone up over the years, but basically when IMS looks at the data, if you look at 100 new prescriptions, 50 to 70 of them arrive at the pharmacy. So what happens to those 30 to 50 folks that don't get there? Well, you've got a prescribed drug. We know drugs are the most cost-effective method of treating patients. We're losing 30 to 50% of the folks not even showing up. How do we get, what kind of technology can we leverage to be able to change just that first drop in the bucket? If we can leverage technology, if we can use technology where the prescription is written and the patient gets the drug, as opposed to the doc doing immediate physician dispensing, but I've got a pharmacist who can help them manage that, why can't I put a pharmacist there? Can I manage the technician who prepares the product using technology to supervise them remotely? If you go back to when I started pharmacy in the 1980s, I put this in the hospital system. I worked midnights. I was the first pharmacist that actually worked midnights. Well, I had to go on codes. The law in the 1980s required me to lock the pharmacy, kick the technicians, and I was in the hospital, kick the technicians out and go on the code. How about if I could use remote supervision where the technicians were inside the pharmacy? I had the ability, using a HIPAA compliance system, and the computer terminals were all over the hospital, where I could remotely supervise them while they were still working. All of this is a change in the way we look at how we practice today by leveraging technology. After you get there, how many are picked up? How many times in the community do we have to do reverse billing every 7 days so that we don't have this? We're building systems to call the patient. We're building systems to get the patient. We've done a lot of things on this end, if you look, coming this way. We talk to the patients, we call them up about the refills. We have refill reminders that go out automatically. We then are monitoring those refill reminders to make sure that they're taking them as prescribed. All of these things we've worked on this end, this is about a change right here where more people get the medication by leveraging technology. It allows us, and it's a quote from Angela, that talks about allowing us to leverage a different kind of relationship that we didn't necessarily have before in different areas and scenarios. We look at rural becoming more rural, but that's not really where on the East Coast the issue is. The East Coast is about access. University of Chicago did a study, because that's what universities do, looking at pharmacy deserts in Chicago. I don't know that anybody would suggest that Chicago is rural. The city of Chicago is not. But what they found was, and it's no different than D.C., that in fact within the city there are pharmacy deserts, that people have difficulty accessing pharmacy services. And what they found in Chicago was that anybody who was more than a mile to the nearest pharmacy had an access concern and access issue, especially when you get to the elderly. So when they did this, they found out that over 1 million residents live in these areas. This area of D.C., and I think there's probably a slide here talking about health professional shortage areas done by the federal government defining those areas. This area of downtown is actually a health professional shortage area in terms of the ability to deliver health professionals' access for patients right here in the center of the city. Oregon did a study that talked about readmission rates. All of the technology that we've got today is designed to get patients out of the hospital quicker, yet keep them healthier so that they don't come back. How do we do that? Can we leverage technology? And using remote dispensing is one way of doing that. The economics, because all of this plays into how we And it'll be interesting because Janet Sylvester is on your program as well. And Janet's going to talk about how we leverage technicians and what we're doing with technicians and the requirements for additional education for technicians. All of that becomes important when you start looking at the economics of it. Sometimes the economics of it doesn't work where a pharmacist can be physically present all the time. But if I can leverage technology and I have a highly qualified technician, I can actually use a remote supervision model to actually deliver product and still give the pharmacist services. So they did some studies. They talked about the economic impact. It makes sense in areas economically to use telepharmacy. These are just some pictures of things that you would see. There's a pediatric hospital. Here's a community health center. Here's a federally qualified health center. All of these places are using remote technology to deliver product and services. Here's a, I believe this one is in Iowa, the interior of, it's a pharmacy. And it has to be a pharmacy by definition because the way that the drugs get there has to meet the DEA requirements for controlled substances to actually have a physical address. When you look at the workflow, and this is the key, if you take a new prescription arriving at the pharmacy, because it has to have a license to have the drugs there, the tech is there, puts in the information into the computer. It is remotely through the cloud, HIPAA compliant cloud, remotely submitted to the pharmacist where the pharmacist is, validates that everything is done correctly. Okay? All of this has gone on through technology. The pharmacist does this, he reviews the images, goes back to the technician. Technician starts to prepare the prescription. The prescription is already prepared. All of the images are taken of the prescription, both the bottle and the label. Verifies the accuracy. The patient can pick up the medication. In some of the states, what we've done, with, especially like Indiana, there are very specific requirements of what has to be done by this particular pharmacist. Must check the prescription monitoring program if it's fulfilled. Must, before the patient gets the medication, must counsel the patient. It's not the offer to counsel. It must be done. Prescription originally, prescription refills. Have to communicate with the patient so that if this were a pharmacy B and it was a hospital and this was a remote hospital clinic, at the doctor, where the doctors were, all of that is done and the interaction happens with the pharmacist. And the pharmacist must, under the rules, do all of that. A lot of opportunities exist for the kind of use of technology at the hospital. There's workload balancing. Some particular pharmacies are busier than others. They can use the technology to leverage the ability of slower times to remotely supervise and check the prescriptions themselves, check the what has been prepared, the pharmacy deserts and communities, and of course, accessible specialists. So I started my career in Florida, and since I started in the 80s, back in the 80s, the HIV/AIDS crisis was huge, but we didn't know what to do. And Belvoir, which is over by Lake Okeechobee, had a huge HIV/AIDS problem. Well, all the specialists were in Miami at Jackson. Could they have been able to deliver using this technology, which of course didn't exist in the 1980s, could they have used this technology to have those HIV/AIDS specialists in Jackson be able to communicate with the rural hospital in Belvoir, like Okeechobee? I think the answer is yes. And what you would have ended up with is better quality care with pharmacists that were the HIV/AIDS at that time beginning to be specialists at Jackson. So a lot of times the questions are fill accuracy. Well, you've got the systems that are designed around fill accuracy, bulk barcoding, and everything else. So we already have that. Safety for the staff and location. You build in requirements like in Indiana, where there are requirements that there be. It's actually interesting the way it was drafted. The legislator was a pharmacist, and so we were talking to him about how to draft it and having the technology to actually make the environment secure. And Indiana has a public records law that the application itself was a public record. So we had to build into the requirement that the where the board was seeing where all of the monitors were in the building was not a public record, so that somebody couldn't go in, get a public record in the pharmacy, take the, you know, where the cameras were to avoid them. Diversion, they built in Indiana requirements for how often the pharmacist was required to go to the location, as well as the types of requirements for inventories. And what to do on internet outages. Those are the kinds of things that have to be addressed in regulations. So when you look at it again, a west-to-east phenomenon, you're beginning to see more and more jurisdictions move that way. I just finished my term last month on the Ohio board, and the board is actually drafting those regulations as we speak. So you're seeing this west-to-east phenomenon occur. So you've got the regulatory authority to exist. It's in there. It's been there for quite some time. If you wanted to adopt the use of this technology, there are some very specific things that you can do, and there are some things that are relatively easy. It doesn't require a statutory change. You've already got the authorization. When you look at, when we did some statistics on DC, there were 25 health professional shortage areas, and including, as I said earlier, downtown, right here in downtown. So that was it. Jessica will do a much better job than I did, but I wanted to at least give you a summary before you sit through and listen to Jessica. She'll give you some more insight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. Wonderful presentation. We want to thank you. Are there questions from any board members, members of the public? We had some really good information. I see Adam has a question or comment.
I do. Thank you very much.
Excellent
presentation. I think it sets the stage nicely for more to hear about this at our upcoming meeting. So just to clarify, telemedicine, does it have to be pharmacy to pharmacy? Can it be pharmacy to some other facility? And let me add a second component to that question. So there is technology that will do a couple of different things. Will allow the patient to pick up a prescription that's already been prepared and is ready. So I'll say it's like a will call, but it's a storage device, and it may be located at a location that's not where the pharmacy is. And there might be an avenue for audiovisual counseling, for example. And then there are devices that will actually fill and label the prescription that also might be off-site, where the pharmacist can validate certain information remotely. And again, the counseling component can be handled remotely as well. So considering all of those things, what do you see in terms of telepharmacy use and how it's actually applying that term to the now ever-evolving environment?
Well, the point that you make is a very valid point, that there are many different mechanisms by which the pharmacist can engage. The model that I gave you here was not a pharmacist to machine. I gave you person to person, so pharmacy to pharmacy. Now, in some instances, those machines themselves, depending upon what they do, may, by virtue of their own statutory definition, have to be a pharmacy.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So some of them are just boxes. Some of them are, I don't know, let's call them Amazon boxes, where you're just picking up and you're using the technology to have it delivered, so it's already been prepared. And you also have the screen for communication with the pharmacist if necessary. That may or may not need to be a pharmacy, because it's just a location where drugs are picked up, if your definition of dispense is the activity over here as opposed to the transaction with the patient. Now, you may build in that model a requirement that you can't open the door until you talk to the pharmacist. But that may either be regulatory or the decision of the person who has the box. Then, because that's version A.
Then there's version B, where it is actually preparing the drug right then and there and labeling it with the machine and talking to the pharmacist. I think in that one it's a little easier case to say it clearly has to be a pharmacy because it's the preparation of the product and the labeling, which fits into the definition of the practice of pharmacy, which is the labeling of the component. And so that one is another method of telepharmacy. And then the third one, which is the one that I gave you here, which is person-to-person, it looks like a pharmacy, and you're remotely supervising a qualified technician. So you've got a person that is engaged in an activity that the statute or the regulation authorizes them to do with that kind of remote supervision. The two machines, you don't necessarily have a person. You have a person in version A delivering it to the Amazon box machine. You have the person in version B that is loading the system, and that may or may not require supervision because the technology may very well be barcoded over here, barcoded over here. It's a smart chip. Doesn't matter where you put it, even if you put it in the wrong spot, the system will do that and know where it is for the purpose of packaging and labeling. So you've really got three models. I think this one doesn't necessarily require a permit. This one, I think, does, and the model that I showed you, which is the real-life pharmacy over here, has these two clearly are. It's questionable whether or not the box really needs one.
Yeah, the second scenario where we're looking at technology outside the pharmacy that's actually preparing the prescription, if you will, and dispensing it, the states are, many of them, going through a legislative process and trying to define whether it needs to be licensed as a pharmacy. There is one state, I think, that so far has said yes.
Right.
There are other states that are theoretically saying it doesn't necessarily have to be licensed, but there has to be certain criteria that are met in terms of that telepharmacy provision.
Well, and if you use, and this one is an easier, Model A is an easier model if you're talking about a nursing home.
Right.
You know, Model B, more of an acute ambulatory care setting.
Right.
My view, and of one,
right,
my view is these two need to be pharmacies because of the processes that are being accomplished. This one not necessarily so. But then again, it goes back to what each individual state law says, and a lot of states are going in to make modifications to their law too, because of the, you started with the word telemedicine, because of the changes in telemedicine and the opportunities in telemedicine, pharmacy is coming along as well. But we're different because we're product and service,
right?
And so what happens is when you go to, I was working with somebody, Pennsylvania. Working in Pennsylvania with a legislator where they had telemedicine, but they included pharmacy in it. And I was explaining to them, well, that's great, except you realize, what are you trying to do? Well, we want them to get their meds. They said, well, you do realize that unless you start talking about the product itself, they're not going to get their meds in telepharmacy the way you drafted your statute until we get to, you know, Star Trek, where I say, 120, you know, gabapentin, please, and then it just produces it. That's not happening right now. So a lot of times, while they think the word telemedicine and you just add pharmacy to it, does it? It only gives you the piece for the communication. It doesn't give you the product. And so sometimes it's statutory, sometimes, and in your case, you already have the statute. It's a question of how you want to define your regulation and how you want to define the people who can do it. And the technology that they use.
Yeah, and our regulations, as you said, have been in place for quite some time, and the landscape has changed. So, you know, there may be an opportunity for us to certainly look at that and consider appropriate updates.
When I was the exec of the board in Kentucky, we got the statute in place in 1998. I left afterwards, but we were waiting for the technology to catch up with the statute. I got the statute changed. We just didn't have any way of doing it at the time. But we knew that this was a logical progression of how to get pharmacists engaged with more patients.
Yeah.
ours are the regulations, so yeah, you're the board, so
yeah, easy
to take a look at that. Yeah. Thank you.
Anything
else?
Any other questions?
Michael, I had a question. Actually, two questions. One about one of the studies, but then also more broadly about how we refer to this as telepharmacy. But the one study indicated that by implementing telepharmacy, there was an increase in number of jobs created in one study. Do you have any insight as to where were those net new jobs created? What caused the creation of new jobs as a result of offering the service in North Dakota or wherever it was?
Yeah, it was North Dakota. And here's what happened. So remember those first two buckets that we talked about in terms of the drop-off on prescriptions being filled? So what happened was the creation of the new jobs was in some instances, they put a telepharmacy in an area that didn't exist. So there's plus one for the technician that didn't exist. Okay. Then what happened over time was more prescriptions were being filled in this rural community. Over at the main pharmacy, because they were also filling prescriptions for the town that they were in, this pharmacist had to hire more pharmacists, starting with a part-time pharmacist, to be able to properly supervise the technician who's over here. So then you get plus one and a half. Then over time, that plus one and a half became plus two because the telepharmacy over here was busy enough to support the pharmacist over here, and the pharmacist would be going periodically to the telepharmacy to have, and this is where the add-on benefit came in. Now we're having diabetes clinics, now we're having immunization clinics, now we're doing all sorts of additional clinical activities in the telepharmacy, scheduled, appointed, all of those things that weren't necessarily happening in that community before. So it became a question, plus one and a half, and plus two over the course of time.
Thank you. And then the broader question, you know, I've heard some clinicians say, you know, we'll know we made it with telemedicine when we no longer call it telemedicine. And I'm wondering, do we have the same sort of thing? It's just medicine. The vehicle through which it's delivered, the medium, you know, everyone's doing Skype calls these days and all that.
This
and all the technology is terribly clunky, I think, still. What does that mean for, are we doing ourselves a disservice as we try to advance new ways to have patients provide care from pharmacists by even having it sort of drag along this baggage of whatever telepharmacy meant in 1998 or whatever it is? I'm just trying to...
Excellent point.
Should we be doing something different around access to care, perhaps, versus calling it... I'm asking you sort of from all your different positions you've had, any observations on that?
I think you're right, which is why I think if you were listening to the subtext of where I was going, which is remote supervision, it's the ability to use to leverage technology to supervise someone in a remote location. I don't necessarily have to call it telepharmacy, but it's the ability to build a system in place that leverages the use of technology to deliver product and services to patients. And as long as, whether it's the machine where you're coming up and talking to me, or better yet, which is where I think, if you look at some of the California regulations where the label has to be in six world languages depending upon the person, it would be so great for me to be able to use technology, technology, to be able to say, here comes a patient. They speak Spanish. I don't. But I can deliver that by getting one of my colleagues to be able to communicate and route that to somebody who speaks Spanish. I'm using technology to deliver pharmacist value in the context of the pharmacist-patient relationship that, quite frankly, I couldn't do. Or Vietnamese, or pick any language. Pick culture. Pick the fact that, as a male, some things are better taken from a woman. I can deliver all of that by having that be part of the technology communication mechanism. And so your point is well taken. I don't know that we have to call it telepharmacy, but it's kind of a shorthand for now to say this is what we're talking about, leveraging technology to deliver pharmacy to companies.
Any other questions?
I have one more question, Dr. Mayne.
Sure.
Appreciate the comments that everyone actually mentioned a while ago. I know it wasn't listed in the presentation today, but I'm curious to see from your vast experience, and I live in Ward 8, so I'm familiar with some of the data you mentioned about the accessing to pharmacies in Ward 8, which has a significantly short number of pharmacies as compared to other wards. In terms of clinical pharmacy delivery models, can you expand or just really quickly tell me how the pharmacist utilize telepharmacy to perhaps advance the practice of pharmacy, so such as delivering optimized disease management or taking care of patients that in a rural setting, but I can still provide some clinical pharmacy delivery services through the telepharmacy.
Sure. And it goes back to something that I said in response to his question. When you look at the plus one and a half, it freed up a pharmacist to actually, and in Indiana we wrote it into the statute, they must go to that pharmacy on a regular cadence as designed by the board. So now the pharmacist is going and doing all of those immunizations, going and doing all of those diabetes clinics that they might otherwise just be rushed to get done. And now what you have is you have a model where you set up the appointments, you're required to go there, patients are going to come in, you invite them in. You are now having appointments. The value inside the psychology of the patient is, well, I have an appointment with Randy, my doc, in 2 weeks. Well, now I have an appointment with my pharmacist a week from now to talk about my medicine. Or I have an appointment with my pharmacist a week after I go see Randy to talk about the medications that were just prescribed. It allows the technology allows the freedom to be able to expand the clinical practice by having the time to do it as opposed to being rushed in between all of the activities. And that goes back to your point about increasing jobs. Now, as I look at it, my role could simply be I'm contracted with several pharmacies that have telepharmacies in the area, and I'm now going to be the judge riding on my horse from location to location to location, where I'm the clinical guy that goes in for a multiple number of pharmacists and pharmacies to be able to do those clinical services. I can expand my sole role into doing just that with patients. Get on a regular cadence. The patients know I'm going to be in this pharmacy on Thursday, every week on Thursday, another pharmacy every week on Wednesday. And the pharmacist has the opportunity to expand their practice by being, if you will, simply clinical. Now, there's a pharmacist that is still responsible for the product at the pharmacy, but now I'm the one that's going and doing all of those clinical services for them. Thank you. Although you wouldn't want me to do it. Just to let you know. I can think of better people than me. Anything else?
Anything else? Well, I can tell you this was a really good appetizer for what's to come in September. I think there are going to be some great questions and maybe some highlights from Pharmacy Deserts right here, you know, in D.C. in terms of giving us a better understanding of what that actually entails. So I'm super excited for the other presentation as well. So thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Thank you. All right. So the next item on our agenda is actually a motion to adjourn. A motion to adjourn the open session. Oh, I'm so sorry. Yep, you're right. I skipped over it. So now is the time that we will take any comments, questions from our wonderful members of the public that have come out to spend some time with us this morning. We only ask that if you would like to make a comment, please state your name. If you are affiliated with any organization, please state that as well. And before you leave, as a reminder, please make sure to sign the sign-in sheet that is floating around or that did float around somewhere in the back. So are there any questions or comments from the public?
I have one. Denise Palooka with Walgreens. I was just wondering if there are any updates to naloxone. I think when you mentioned the grant from SAMHSA, I was excited to see if there was anything educational for our pharmacists that need to dispense naloxone or via standing order or something as we were waiting for a training module to go out in order to do so.
So no, we don't have any current updates right now. As soon as we do have some updates, we will provide them to the public through email communication. So no, there are no updates right now.
Thank you.
Yes.
Hi, Andrew Gentles, representative of the Washington, D.C. Pharmacy Association. To Dr. Bernard's comment, I actually just wanted to say the association is actually really excited about the District 102 meeting, so we've also listed the website on our page. So if you guys are at dcpha.com, we have it listed as an upcoming event, so we're really excited about that. And this is really nice to see come to the District of Columbia. So I have twofold just to add some urgency to what my colleague Denise Ruka mentioned. I know back in April, earlier this year, Mayor Bowser sent a letter to Chairman Mendelson, and I'll just read really quickly. It says, you know, their Chairman Mendelson, in close consideration and approval by the Council, is a Substance Abuse and Opioid Overdose Prevention Amendment Act of 2018. These amendments are necessary to ensure that the original legislation is consistent with the scope of practice of pharmacy to place the oversight and approval of the training programs for pharmacists onto the Board of Pharmacy instead of the Department of Health. And it's a very, very well-written letter. And in there, she does mention, since the Board of Pharmacy has nearly completed creation of the training program that will be administered through the Center for Rational Prescribing and available on the DOA site, the proposed 2018 legislation will ensure that this training program is essentially successful. I wanted to add some urgency to this because with the naloxone opioid issue, we looked at the data for 2017 in terms of the hotspots for opioid epidemics. And I can tell you that the Department of Health is really encouraging to share this heavy data with us. And you can see that it's just significant hotspots in Ward 7 and 8. And these hotspots equate to fatalities. They equate to overdoses. I think we're seeing, too, from the Surgeon General, there's a big push for all of us to get involved, even saying members of the public should have naloxone on them. So for me and the association, there was a little bit of, I guess, frustration in that we have an educational program that is essentially seen as a last barrier for pharmacists to be able to utilize the regs that are on the books. And so we're tracking this closely, but I think it does a little bit for the service of the profession if it says we don't have any more further updates. I'm not sure if the patients that are experiencing these overdoses or the ability for pharmacists that are excited to get involved, if that's a response that we'd love to relate to them and say, hey, listen, we're working on it, but we have more details. So I really kind of champion Ms. White to really say, we'd like to get more information on this. We'd really like to see what are some timelines. The mayor has talked about this, and the District of Columbia, the patients, the wards, they're experiencing this. So why is there a delay, and we'd like to get some more details. That's the first.
Okay, so thank you. I'm sorry, you say, is it Dr. Gentle?
Call me Andrew.
Andrew, okay, yeah. Thank you. So currently right now, for the record, DC Health, we do have a naloxone training program that anyone from the public can attend and get naloxone. That training program is it twice a month?
It's every other month.
Every other month. So if anyone is interested in participating in that training program, we do understand that it's urgent and we do want to move this forward. So we are working on it, but right now we don't have any updates. So as soon as we do have any updates, it's definitely a priority for us here. We will definitely let everyone know.
Do you feel it would be something, is it too much to ask if this could be a holiday present for everyone? Or a Christmas present?
So thank you for bringing that up, and let me just add one additional piece of information. It's my understanding, and I did see that letter and the supplemental material that went along with it, that a piece of legislation has been introduced in the council, and I believe, and I have to get confirmation on this, but I believe there was a hearing on or around July 11th, and that legislation was specifically to qualify a previous law that was passed sometime
earlier, maybe a year or two earlier. And so I think we're waiting for council now to take action on that piece of legislation to do exactly what you said, which will then allow the board to move forward.
That's
so,
council of the whole.
What, I'm sorry, what's that?
From council of the whole.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. So it might have just been a committee meeting, hearing, and then the council of the whole will vote. And assuming the council approves that legislation, that will give the board the authority to kind of close the loop on these final little pieces that are still missing. Is that?
Yes, that's correct. So we mentioned that at the last open session meeting about the hearing. So that was the June meeting. I'm not sure. I don't remember if you were in attendance or not, but we did mention about the hearing that will be taking place in July. So we're just kind of waiting, but we definitely understand it's definitely a priority. So your point is well taken.
And you had a second.
I did have a second question. So it's been my longstanding area of concern or champion. So having come from Indian Health Service and you know familiar with some of the studies in North Dakota, et cetera, and the VA models, I'm going to just talk about collaborative practice agreement. Anywhere closer to issuing the regulations for this? I know there's some smiles because I came here, was it last year? I've been tracking this closely. I think the last minutes I had was back in August. And it says, currently undergoing the legal sufficiency review and approval process. That was back in August of last year. This change, please let me know, but I'd love to kind of get a pulse of where this is right now. Just kind of a background to Community Hope, which is one of the largest federally qualified health centers in the district. The CEO and the medical directors are all behind this, and they've even asked me to come here and ask, you know, what's the current status with this? Where is this going, and what's the current movement? I'd like to get a good feel for that as well. Thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you. So who would like to respond?
So I can tell you that the Board of Pharmacy promulgated regulations in partnership with the Board of Medicine. Try to keep my nomenclature state for the different states here. And we went through a public comment period. But again, the two agencies met, came up with final regulations. They've been approved by both agencies. We, too, were just waiting for final approval so that they can be published as final and implementation can occur. That's it. It's out of our hands. It's out of the Board of Medicine's hands. It just has to go through a government approval process, if you will, with D.C. And once it goes through all of those check boxes, then it's published in the D.C. Register as final. We're waiting as well.
So the application, is it being reviewed by the Department of Health at this moment in time?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just going through the typical process that all regulations that are approved by the boards have to go through. And I think there are a lot of different steps that it has to follow.
Okay.
Thank you.
As a member of the board, I feel compelled to add one closing comment to all this. On both the cases you've identified, Andrew, and you articulated the concerns perfectly. The board shares your concerns on both and on the pace at which they're moving, but the board has taken proactive, assertive steps in both cases to do its part to prepare in terms of the training program on naloxone, as well as the work around collaborative practice. We're pushing it as fast, as hard as we can, and we too are in the same waiting pattern. And I won't speak for the board. I'll just say I have a personal frustration at the pace of some of these things because of the impact on patients in District of Columbia, our inability to move forward on both of them. The need is real. It's evident. But the pace of change is not what it needs to be. Things are not moving as fast as I feel they should for the District of Columbia residents.
That was well said. Thank you.
Okay, and I think it's important for you all as a public to kind of understand the role that you play. one of the reasons we ask you to come to these meetings is so that you can raise questions of concern, you can get clarification and updates on things that are important, and you can keep doing whatever you can to make sure that the outcomes for residents of the District of Columbia are what they should be. And so your questions, you know, they are appreciated. There are processes that sometimes we just don't have control of. However, I think the commitment and the energy and the effort on behalf of your colleagues here on the board is still right there, and we look forward to things kind of going through the process as well. Any other questions? No? All right. Well, if there are no other questions, we will entertain a motion to adjourn the open session. And so if one of my wonderful board colleagues will make a motion, you can refer to page 4.
All right, I'm going to take a breath before this one. Madam Chair, I move that the board close the open public session portion of the meeting and move into the closed executive session portion of the meeting pursuant to D.C. Official Code S-575B for the following purposes: to discuss disciplinary matters pursuant to S-2-575B-9, to seek the advice of counsel to the board, to preserve the attorney-client privilege, and to approve settlement agreements pursuant to S-2-575B4, and to plan, discuss, or hear reports concerning ongoing or planned investigations pursuant to S-2-575B14.
Okay, thank you. Take a breather. Okay, so there.